and gentlemen, a copy of the agenda was circulated. And taking that you all have, but if you don't have, can you indicate by show of hands so that we can give you one? We're now on item number one, which is opening and welcome. I'd like us to bow our heads and observe a moment of silence for prayer or meditation. Thank you. Honourable members, good morning. And good morning to National Treasury Delegation. I'd also like to greet the staff, the hardworking staff, and all guests present here. I wish to welcome all of you to this very important meeting, whereby we will be receiving a briefing from the National Treasury on work underway by the National Treasury in a number of areas, including work by the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, work on the budget facility for infrastructure, the streamlining of public entities and other major spending areas. As honorable members would recall, state expenditure, especially in the area of procurement, is one of the key mechanisms that will enable government to implement its developmental policies. Effectiveness in infrastructure spend, rationalized and streamlined public entities, curbing wasteful and fruitless expenditure, preventing procurement deviations and price escalations are a priority focus area in the medium term. So these are issues that are a direct concern to the committee, as our mandate as provided for in the Money Bills Act directs that SCOA must deal with all spending issues of government. In this sense, the National Treasury is an important partner or stakeholder in our objectives of ensuring efficiency, effectiveness, and value for money in all government. I'd like to thank you once more for coming, and this is our meeting. The meeting is declared open, and I'm looking forward to meaningful and constructive engagement. Meaningful and constructive engagement. Thank you very much. The meeting is declared open. In terms of the agenda, we'll then move on to apologies.
Madam Chairperson, honourable members and guests, we received one apology from Mr. Sheikh Imam, who is attending another committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable members, do you accept the apology? Thank you. We then move on to item number three, which is, okay, before we move on to item number three, I would like to welcome Honourable Member Maswanganyi as the member who is joining this as a permanent member of this, joining the committee as a permanent member of the committee, and indeed we're looking forward to your quality and constructive contributions to this meeting. Thank you so much. We feel privileged to have you here. Thank you.
Yes.
Now, I don't know whether we should do introductions, but we know all, we must allow people to introduce themselves as and when they speak, which would be the best for the honourable members.
Yes.
Introduce ourselves, okay? Shall we then introduce ourselves? Starting from myself, I'm Pinky Yvonne Posa. I'm the chairperson of the committee. Honourable Member, I will start this time with the Honourable Member and then we end up with National Treasurer.
Good morning, I'm Peter Bakoban, Chief of the Commission.
Good morning,
I'm Paul Demanana, Member of the Commission.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jolene Demanana, Member of the Commission.
Good morning, everybody. Alan McLaughlin, I'm a member of the Committee.
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm Joe Masonda, new member of the committee.
My name is Kerelani Jomo, the researcher for the committee. Thank you.
Good morning, Darren Arons, committee secretary.
Good morning, my name is Mpho Ngumalo. I'm from the National Treasury, responsible for SCM policy and legal under the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer.
Let's follow the agenda.
remember, I think they have all senior roles.
Yeah.
In three or two years old. Just maybe within our meeting.
Well, then I suggest, I think let's stick to the agenda as it stands.
Okay.
Of course, a lot of the work that the OCPO is doing will overlap with the discussion of the institute. So there might be an argument for swapping those two around. But let's just stick to the agenda for now, and I'm sure in the course of the discussion the others will chip in as required.
Okay.
So the first presentation is going to be done by Mr. Silvan Manak, who you've just been introduced to. As he said, he's heading up the Public Entities Governance Unit, and of course, it's a very important part of the budget. It's a very large part of the budget, a consolidated budget. So, just for those of you who perhaps aren't very familiar with the structure of the consolidated budget of government, in general, when, for example, we're talking about the budget deficit, or about gross tax revenue and so on. When we're talking about taxes, we're usually talking about what's called the main budget, which is the main budget of government. That's everything that's funded through the National Revenue Fund. But we also have a measure of government spending, which we call a consolidated budget. And included in the consolidated budget is something called the National Public Entities, which Gulam is now going to talk to you about. But basically, these national public entities are funded by and large by transfers from national departments. And as Gulam will explain to you, the national entities actually have a fair amount of autonomy, and they report to the department which has generally created them and funded them. And of course, the reason why we're here today is because these entities are significant, financially significant, and in addition to that, there's a little big question about the efficiency of the spending that's taking place at public entity level. From a national treasury perspective, it's been quite a struggle, for example, just to get better quality in financial data out of public entities, and for that reason, although the topic today is around the closing and restructuring of public entities, we've also included, for your interest, some slides at the back of the presentation just to give you a sense of what is the financial position of these entities and how big are they. And the answer is it's a very significant part of the total budget. So we're talking about, for example, a national entities accounting for around 119 billion rand worth of spend in the fiscal year 2017-18. And of course, if you look again, for example, at some of the other slides, you'll note that one of the issues we have is the ability to monitor these entities, to collect data on these entities. And if you look at the numbers, you can say without doubt the public entity sphere is the area in which there's consistently the largest underspending, and in which the general sense of the efficiency of spend needs to be improved. So, what we're here for today is precisely to talk about how do restructurings, closings, mergers of public entities take place, what are the rules, who has the power to do that, and what are some of the examples of what's been happening in that space since we talked about it in the budget in 2016. Okay, so I think I'll hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Jenny. Morning, honorable members. I'm going to refer you to an attachment that was given to you in the document that you have. It's the public institutions listed in terms of the PFMA Schedule 1, 2, 3A, 3B, 3C, and 3D. And this is the document that I'm referring to here. So I'll make reference to this one as well.
Can we get all the documents? Because I don't have one. Please make sure that everybody has the documents. I'm saying everybody, I don't have one.
Executive authorities,
should be held politically accountable for all the policies and the institutions that fall under these or their control. Responsibility should be clearly spelled out in the Establishment Act and the policy framework, and delegations of powers and responsibility should accompany and be consistent with the devolution of functions. And Chair, I'd like you to turn you to your attention to slide 5, which you'll see is a structure of some sort. And this structure identifies and gives perspective of the kind of institutions that we have. So at the top end you have the structure of public entities and the structure of government, excluding local government. The Public Finance Management Act deals with entities or financing arrangements at both the national and provincial level. We have on your left-hand side general government, which is made up of the institutions established in terms of the Public Service Act. These are departments. Under that will be national departments and provincial departments and departmental agencies. These are government components that have been established in terms of the Public Service Act. And then you'll see there's a separation, a line between those. And the column adjacent to that is public entities. In this section, we deal with, we have stewardship entities, regulating entities, regulatory entities, research entities, statutory advisory entities, and service delivery entities. Now, in the attention that I was referring to, when you look at those under Schedule 3A, you'll see there's a variety of institutions that we have. And for example, if I can take you to page 4 of 11, and you'll see there are not, just pick up one, and, item 67, for example, is the National Credit Regulator. The National Credit Regulator will be regarded as a regulating entity. These are entities that are established to perform a regulating function on behalf of government. Then we have stewardship entities, entities for which government will have it has the function of maintaining the stewardship of those institutions. Here we're thinking about cultural institutions, etc. Research entities, the likes of these are the Human Science Research Council, Medical Research Council, CSIR, and other institutions. Service delivery entities, these are essentially entities that are established to provide services and maintain the service delivery impetus of government, programs of government. Here we're talking about SARS, we're talking about the South African Social Security Agency, and then falling. And then we also have statutory advisory bodies. So some of these are established in terms of law. They don't meet the requirements for listing, and therefore they are not listed on this particular document. Then attached to that, or adjacent to that, we'll see government enterprises. Here we have, these are essentially entities that will be listed under Schedule 2 or Schedule 3B or 3D at the provincial level. These are statutory corporations, state-owned companies, financial intermediaries, and subsidiaries of public entities. Statutory corporations are the essence of SABC. State-owned companies are Eskom and Transnet. Financial intermediaries are the IDC, the Development Bank, and other DFI institutions that government has. State interest companies, these would be water boards that are established there. And then lastly, on the same slide, you'll see right on the far right of your slide, public sphere institutions. These are tertiary institutions and public sphere, public interest institutions. These are all outside the PFMA. There's no statutory obligation to list these. They don't meet the definition of listing, and therefore they are not listed in terms of the PFMA. Tertiary institutions are specifically, high institutions of higher learning are specifically excluded from listing in terms of the PFMA. And other public interest organizations we have are professional bodies and other bodies that are established in terms of law. So what I
if I'm going too fast, please stop me saying, or I'm going to take any questions.
Oh, no, no, I'm still okay.
Prohibitive corporate forms. So some of the corporate forms that we have, non-profit organizations and previously known as Section 21 companies, these are quite problematic in the way they are set up. They cannot pay dividends or reallocate surpluses, and when they are dissolved, the reallocation of the assets is very complicated, and it's unclear on the establishment of these who will be, which members will be responsible for play the role of counting authority in this regard, and what the future of this trust or NGOs will be. So for purposes of that, we discourage institutions to be established as non-profit organizations. We would like them to have their own enabling legislation, and this forms the basis in terms of how this works. We don't like trust, ad hoc funds, corporates, and close corporations. For the same reasons that I noted earlier, the governance arrangement becomes extremely problematic, and it becomes very difficult for us to manage those. Subsidiaries of public entities, there's a feeling in the Treasury that says the subsidiaries can bring you more risk than the holding company, and therefore we have to be very cautious when we establish subsidiaries for public entities. Shared services centers also have their own challenges. And for that reason, we don't we choose often not to have them as part of our preferred corporate form. So issues related to listing, I'm on slide 7. A national public entity is defined in terms of the FMA. It's defined as a board, a commission, company, corporation, fund, or other entity other than a national government business enterprise, which is once established in terms of legislation, which is fully or substantially funded either from the National Revenue Fund or by way of the tax or levy or other money imposed in terms of national legislation, and is accountable to Parliament, not directly but through the ministers in terms of Section 92 of the Constitution. Ministers are responsible to report to Parliament on all matters related to their budget. And if they meet all of that criteria, then Section 47.2 of the PFMA provides that the accounting authority, which is the board of a public entity, that is not listed in either Schedule 2 or 3, must without delay notify the National Treasury in writing that the public entity is not listed. And of course, it's then for the minister to exercise discretion on whether that entity should be listed for purposes of public financial management, the way with the mechanism that it should use to deal with its financing, accounting, governance, and other arrangements. Now, this is key, and I noted this in specific for giving you an idea of what are the criteria for listing a particular public entity. If it meets this criteria, then the minister must consider and list the institution in either Schedule 2 or 3 in the event that entity is not. Section 38.1M of the PFMA, I'm referring to slide 8, and the purpose of this is to submit proposals for the accounting officers of the department to submit proposals to the National Treasury to consider granting consent to the accounting officer who intends to establish or take the initiative in establishing a new entity. So when a new entity is conceptualized, the accounting officer has a duty to, in terms of this section, write to the National Treasury and seek approval for the establishment of that entity before it does so. And this is critical. The implementation of this is sometimes problematic because accounting officers don't get the approval from the National Treasury to establish these entities. They already start the process, they already start developing legislation, and then later we are engaged on to of course provide funding for this entity if it so meets the requirements for that. There's an interim process that Cabinet has approved. We require a business case to be established, a feasibility study, and this is of course assessed by an evaluation panel consisting of officials from the Presidency, National Treasury, and DBSS. Section, I refer to now to slide 9. Section 51.1G of the PSMA. This makes provision for the responsibility of an accounting authority of an entity that is already established, that wishes to now establish a subsidiary, for example, for them to in due course notify the National Treasury, promptly notify the National Treasury, and allow the National Treasury sufficient time to consider its decision about the feasibility of establishing this new entity. So this is also governed or managed in terms of an interim process that has been approved by Cabinet. There's an evaluation process, an evaluation panel that again consists of officials from National Treasury and DPSA. The Presidency hasn't been playing a role in here, but we want to involve them much more in this particular as well. And then Section 54.2 on slide 10, this makes provision for before a public entity concludes any of the following transactions. For example, in establishing or participation in the establishment of a company, participation in a significant partnership, trust, unincorporated joint venture or similar arrangement, in the acquisition or disposal of a significant shareholding in the company, acquisition or disposal of a significant asset in the company or entity, commencement or cessation of a significant business activity, and a significant change in the nature or extent of its interest in a significant partnership, trust, unincorporated joint venture, or similar arrangement. The accounting authority must promptly and in writing inform the relevant treasury of such a transaction or such an arrangement changes to that arrangement. It must, the responsibility for this also lies with the executive authority. In other words, the executive authority of a department of an entity responsible for it would be responsible for making sure that the arrangements in terms of Section 54.2 are dealt with. In this instance, it's important to note that National Treasury is only notified for purposes of information, and we are not consulted on specifically requiring approval in any of these particular transactions. But we do engage on them, and we do engage with them to understand what the impact, the financial impact, will be of those emerging changes. And now take you to slide 11. On slide 11, provincial public entities will be delisted. So these are entities at the provincial level which have, through this process of restructuring and reorganizing, been delisted. In the Free State, we delisted the Free State Tourism Authority. In the Bogo, the various entities that you see there on slide 11. In Mpumalanga, we delisted the Mpumalanga Gambling Board and the Mpumalanga Liquor Authority. These were consolidated to form the Mpumalanga Economic Regulator. These functions will now be performed by the new entity, and then in Northwest, the Provincial Energy Resources Authority will also be there. So this is giving you some idea in terms of how we're managing these particular entities. There's continuous engagement between Treasury in terms of its intergovernmental unit, the relations unit, with the provincial Treasury to focus on restructuring and reorganizing of provincial energy. On slide 12, we also have a DFI consolidation taking place at the national level. The consolidation is to create a single human settlements development bank, and this will result from the merger of the Rural Housing Loan Finance Corporation, NURCHA, and the National Housing Finance Corporation. Those three entities will come together, will be merged to form that single entity. So if you refer again to the annexures that I've provided you, you will see that at some time those three entities will be delisted and a new entity called the Human Settlement Development Bank will be listed. The merger of this has already begun in practice. Treasury has given some approval for this to be taken place. We are still waiting a formal submission of the business case and the draft legislation by the Department of Human Settlement. there are concerns that we have raised in this regard. Those concerns are that there is no clear market failure identified for the establishment of this particular entity. And these are engagements that we have noted in our correspondences and our engagements with the department. The Human Settlement Development Bank wishes to undertake all the previous DFI activities plus more, and there are no cost efficiencies gained from the consolidation. So our focus will be on what economies of scale and efficiencies are gained as a result of this. And there are trade-offs and opportunity costs from shifting funds from subsidy housing grants to capitalize the Human Settlement Development Bank has not been explicitly considered. So there are a number of issues that the National Treasury is in engagement with the department on these various matters. Now, members, I'd like to refer you then, this is, of course, if your time is your own leisure, you can read the section related to the breakdown of spending in public entities that will give you some kind of analysis and some kind of basis on where the money is really going. Ian earlier did allude to this, and he also alluded to some of the problems that we had in this sector. Thank you, members.
Thank you for the presentation. You remember at some stage when we engaged with National Treasury, we said that there are many public entities. Not good enough. Can we get information on all these public entities? Now, today, National Treasury is here, and this presentation. I just want to find out from honorable members if they have clarity to the question. Where government is also spending money on the public entities. So, honourable member Fuguayani, honourable member Manana, honourable member Tomasa, honourable member Maplossi, honourable member Maswangani. Right in that order, and please, in our intervention, can we be short into the point because we've got how many more presentations? Three before one. We have to go and have lunch. Three more presentations. Short into the point. Thank you very much. What you want to remember? Thank you very much, Chair. Just on the issue of destroying the process from the students, the NPO, and also the sessions in one company where you refer to them as the community. That's the last one, saying that on establishment stands here with the member of the and with what authority that within or with what authority they have. But actually, it's been happening. So just to get a sense of what has been happening then, because now we are saying that there is no clarity actually. That's what I think is good. And then the other point of the slide is the issue of shared service centers. What is the difference between the shared service centers? The other question is in the direction. There are a good number for us to be able to function better. And the last one is the issue of the housing DFI consolidation. And I think, okay, it is in the process of being formed or established or whatever. Right now, Treasury is very important. Does this mean that before the establishment, Treasury was not even in the process? Thanks.
Thank you very much, Nate.
Thank you very much, Professor. You're welcome.
The presentation is long and not solid. No admission. Because we will show there so many. But luckily today, we have a presentation committee. And know the same slide number 6. If I get it correctly, you're saying you don't like this car as old according to the rules. Maybe you can elaborate on that. You talk about the non-profit and you talk about the entity. The entity is not part of the provincial authority code. When I look at this document that you presented to us for this entity, it seems as if each and every province just coming out of its own entity, and it seems as if one, it is not coordinated in a correct manner. Each province will do link up what others link up authority and so on and so forth. It is not giving a problem.
Thank you. Honorable Member Tabata.
Then why would, for instance, the department establish an entity with a very specific mandate, and then the entity itself begins to establish other subsidiaries under it? What's the purpose of creating a better network of because one understands the very department establishment because it wants to participate in the problem. It's like saying, I must do a particular piece of work under the manager. And I say, I'm asking my colleague, Honor Manana, to do another piece of work for me, and she devolves another part of it to someone else. And you do so, you create further complication and the network of little structures will become difficult to check. This web becomes difficult to check. This training becomes difficult to check. And how the visibility line gets back in the process. The best thing question is relevant with slide 8, where the thing is an accounting officer. They establish an entity. And one again asked the same question, you have an accounting officer who has
employed staff under him or her if they do not perform specific duties. And these are educated, skilled, ethics. And why then include staff, number of staff structure under his or family aware of structures that get lost in the past. So. I think the last chapter slide 12. The measure that you refresh to all of those when the major was also what continues to be the former Minister of Human Development announced the establishment of the state of the and one would have imagined that would have been a result of the major honor of publish a paper when you start to measure. So we don't know whether that bank is established in name or whether it's been established and it's functioning and so on alongside the business and so on. But lastly, chapter that you raised the question before you worry whether this loss of money to the not actually to the academies funding a large number of entities and sub-entities and other things. Especially in the light of the current big crisis and the economic environment that we face throughout the world.
Thank you.
Honourable Member
McLaughlin. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, just generally, when I had a look at this last night, I was horrified at some of the things that I saw here by virtue of the implications. Just the first one, slide number two, for example. Why improve the policy framework? Well, it seems to me there's a lot of problems in this right now. That's why we're not trying to accept it. And when I see saying I ensure that public resources are subject to an appropriate degree of governance and oversight,
mm-hmm.
What has been the case in the past?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have none.
Mm.
If we're only doing it now. And what's happened, as Honourable Barber said, for the last 2 years? What's been going on? It's just like in this huge, big open door where everybody can just go and fish whatever they like out of it. When you look at the provisions of the BFMA and how things operate, who has the authority to institute things, where it goes to, and you see this long list of enterprises. It just gives rise to this whole culture of empire building. Anybody who wants to can establish entities all over the place. The one entity establishes another, and so it goes on. The lack of control must be mindful. I don't know how National Treasury attempts to deal with this in terms of trying to find out what's happening to the money, is it being spent in the right place? Which gives rise to my next question, how do you measure the effectiveness of all the money we're spending? Is there any way we can? Has it ever been attempted? Are there targets set somewhere that one can measure the expenditure against the target achievement? Is it part of what you do? Or is it only if and when the Auditor General gets around to having a look at this and he can go through that kind of exercise? You can tell me that's too late, that's always after the fact. Surely we must have some kind of process where before we commit to the spending of the money, we've got some idea of what we're hoping to achieve with that expenditure, and not just randomly jump into it. In slide 3, you talk about each of the corporate forms, but you don't give us any detail of what those corporate forms are. We speak of entities, we speak of enterprises, we speak of state-owned companies. Can you just give us a little more sort of definition and clarity of which are which, and how does those slot together? What would cause a state-owned company to be different from a state-owned enterprise? What is an entity as regards an enterprise, or is it just a generic term that covers everything? That would just be a little more specific for us. I was just a little confused. Slide 5, it looks like. And the heading is prohibited corporate forms. Then your first bullet point says the following corporate forms are to be curtailed. Now, curtailed to me means reduced. We don't try to do it anymore. Are they now prohibited, or are they just being curtailed? Or are we stopping it, or are we outlawing it altogether? Maybe get some clarity on that. When I looked as well at some of the accompanying information we get, it's concerning to me that we're spending a little bit less on our state-owned enterprises than we spend, for example, on local government. On the national produced revenue, we're spending about 9% on local government and 8.5% on state-owned enterprises. Are we getting any value for our money here? What is the real turnaround? What are we getting for all this money we spend? If I look at, these slides aren't numbered. They all have the same number on them, the ones that are attached. The one that's breakdown of spending, consolidated government spending national public entities by functional classification. For example, economic development function accounts for the majority of spending at 108.9 billion, 54.5%. Then if you look at the next slide, it tells you the sectors that contribute the most to underspending are community development, learning and culture, and economic development. Now, economic development is absorbing more than half the expenditure, and yet it's underspending. It's just scary sort of stuff, because they spend all this money, but they're not achieving. They're underspending. They're not achieving what they set out to do, and yet they're spending so much money. What's being achieved? What actual economic development has been achieved with all this expenditure? Learning and culture. 20% of the spending is on learning and culture. What is learning and culture? Can we get some idea of what it means? What is learning and culture? I don't understand what that specifically says to me. Compensation of employees. We spend 24% on compensation of employees, but only 14% on capital expenditure. This is an imbalance to my way of thinking. Surely we're supposed to be, this is after all for developmental purposes, we're supposed to be achieving something other than just giving people money. Surely on a national level we should have something to show. We should have some idea of pride. We've achieved these things. We've spent money in our national entities and we've achieved things. We've got something to show for, something to be proud of. I don't see it though. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, colleagues and officials. Thank you, Chair. And welcome the presentation from the service of Carlo.
Manak.
Okay. Thanks. Referring to Chairperson, I was not here before when you commissioned this report. That is in the form of PowerPoint presentation without a narrative. If it was in a narrative form, it would have more meat. But it is high level. The way designed the document. It's like somebody who has got a better understanding of what is happening in that sector. And now they are dealing with specific issues. Because there are classifications beyond what is here. No, not all entities are supposed to be commercial services. To the school of government. They are established for a particular purpose, which in the main can be social. So there are commercial DFIs, financial institutions that you have, digital corporation and non-commercial. So I thought, Mr. Mana, that is very important for us, because you have just outlined all of them, which ones are commercial, which ones are non-commercial, which ones are DFIs, and which ones are statutory corporations, and so on and so on, so that we have a better understanding of the purpose of the establishment and what they are doing now. I'm not sure, Chairperson, maybe because there are entities that fall under local government, why they are not here, this regulated by MFNA, or that was the purpose. Okay, that was the purpose, I don't have a problem. But what should also be clarified, Chairperson, is that there is a Presidential Review Committee that is looking at these entities. I thought in the introduction of that one, that should have been indicated. So that it's like, there's no work being done, there's a lot of work being done to review them. With an intention to merge some of them, with an intention to re-establish some of them, and so on and so on. Lots of case studies have been done in that regard. Most of these entities have a problem of governance. I see somewhere, Mr. Manan, slide 3 is proposing bullet point 4 that the framework should provide the possibility of growth path towards greater autonomy. I don't know if that's what you want. More autonomy for entities. I understand government is the shareholder. So these are not private companies, out there. These are wholly owned by government. The board is the accounting authority, and the minister is the executive authority. So why should they be more autonomous? They're just there to fulfill a particular function. I will want clarity in that regard. That's why do you move towards more autonomy, because that's what is creating problem for some of these entities as of now. Then the last issue, Chairperson, I think, are they all posited by the Auditor General for South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you. Just to talk up the issue on the Presidential Review Commission, I'd like to know your involvement. I don't know where are we in terms of this report? Are we at the implementation stage? I know that there was a report, and if we are at the implementation stage, who is responsible for the implementation and what progress? And your involvement. Okay. Then, on the provincial public entity to be delisted. Now, who is responsible for delisting? Is it National Treasury? And National Treasury, do you have a work plan? Because a work plan would have time frames. So that we can know by when can we expect it to be completed. And also on slide 1. See on your document right at the back where you are referring to the EMA monitoring.
the bullet number 3, we would like to thank National Treasury for implementation of our recommendation, because in engagement like this, that we then get made aware of the gap, and also the fact that you have responded to the gap, because in our engagement on this, we did request for this, and we can see that you are really implementing this, and this is a good day. We are impressed, and thank you very much. But we'd like to know, in terms of reporting, will you then be able to, because on your quarterly report, we'd like this report to come in there. The National Section 32 report, we'd like this to come in there. So that we can be closely monitored and make sure that the problems that we're situated today are dealt with timely as before, and not upcoming at the tail end when they are still in the program. We will now hand over to National Treasury to respond, but in your responses, sir, we will appreciate if you can also be short and to the point. Thank you.
Okay, well, sitting on the other side, I was just speaking to the gentleman. So thank you very much for the question and the comments that will be helpful. I hope that I'll be able to answer all the questions. We are not looking to make that information available to you. So if we address the issues around the prohibited corporate forms, quite a few questions around that. Issues around the NGOs, the trust, the methods related to the establishment of subsidiaries, and those particular points. So in some instances, Section 21 companies, if I was called it non-profit organizations, are a form of the corporate form that is available in terms of the Companies Act, by virtue of the Companies Act, who are entitled to have a non-profit company, or under the previous Companies Act, Section 21 company. And some public entities were established in terms of that particular legislation. So Section 21 companies were established in terms of the Companies Act. They were legal, there was nothing wrong with that, there was nothing offensive, and the executive authority took the decision to establish those entities as Section 21 companies. And for the reasons that I present, notably those, the governance arrangements are very problematic, but they have members, not shareholders. And when you dissolve Section 21 companies, you have to transfer those assets to a similar kind of institution that deals with similar members. Now, that becomes very problematic. Investing in government cases, we have this company which we have funded, and now it can't pay dividends because it's not a dividend paying company. When we dissolve it, where do the assets go? How do we deal with it? Now, these are issues that we have picked up over time. When we talk about prohibited corporate forms, in engaging with departments when they are establishing entities, this is the time when we engage on them. To say this is not a corporate form that we are in support of. It has been the case in the past that we have limited that. We've curtailed a number of those institutions that have since, or where they are looking to establish that. We would now be very clear in saying why we don't want to establish those and what the problems are that we have experienced in the past. So I think it's an improvement from where we came. So some of the issues are in relation to trust and corporates. So subsidiaries of public entities are established in terms of, again, also the Companies Act, and the legal requirements to establish the such. If one considers as part of legislation of a public entity, there would be a developmental focus. In other words, it would say they can establish a foundation of some sort, one, or they can establish CSI, corporate services, initiatives to undertake corporate services initiatives, and all in addition, they may also be allowed to operate beyond the borders of South Africa. So, for example, the ATNS, amongst their mandate, they can be developmental training and other undertake other functions. So, it would be appropriate for them not to do that, undertake those functions within the current structure, but rather establish a new structure, a new company, so that they can consolidate their efforts and keep that away from their core business and so forth. And in some instances, for purposes of tax and reporting, it makes sense for them to have that particular corporate form. It's not preferred. We only look at it where there's a clear business case for them to undertake those particular activities, where they would be receiving revenues for the services that they are offering in terms of that. There would be clear cut ring fencing of those operations, etc. But for purposes of the PFMA, all of those facilities are consolidated within the main area. So if you look at, for example, the schedules that I've given you, if you look at on page 2 of that schedule 2, you'll see that all the subsidiaries of the above major public entities are then also included as part of the listing that they have. We don't list them specifically, but they are for purposes of consolidation and reporting. The auditor general then would consolidate all of the reporting from those subsidiaries. So they are definitely counted in the consolidation numbers of those entities. So the question in terms of which entities that we took over from the old government, old regime. So quite a few of the major public entities came from there. Some of these were established by legislation. Think about Eskom, dates back quite far back. But one of the most significant ones that we took over was the IDT, the Independent Development Trust, which came from this at the time. Late 80s, early 90s, when we were specifically established as an education trust at one time. But those are kind of the institutions that we have to take over. In relation to the classification, what we intended here is an improvement on what we currently have. So this doesn't mean to say that what is happening now or there's nothing happening at this point in time. We're intending to bring a new perspective and improve the monitoring and mechanisms in place for appropriately classifying our institutions. It's not about being static or complacent about where they are, etc. In terms of the Presidential Review Commission, the National Treasury played a key role in assisting this review committee that was headed up by General Biafra on the issues. There are a number of recommendations that have been tabled. There was a report that was tabled. Our current president was the deputy president at the time, and he was leading and chairing an intergovernmental interministerial committee on implementing the recommendations. And those are still continuing today. Some of that work is being undertaken by Department of Public Enterprises with the National Treasury's Assets and Liability Unit and the Public Entities Governance Unit as well on looking to implement some of the recommendations that they have made. In terms of the structure, so government business enterprises means that they are substantially funded from their own revenues that they have generated for services that they are offering. To think of Transnet would not receive any direct funding on budget. They would raise their own revenues, and the same for Eskom, and the same for some of the other public corporations that we have. In terms of the classification framework, those entities that are listed in Schedule 3A in particular, these are national public entities, and these are entities that or called as agencies of government, who operate as extensions of government and therefore need some kind of funding for carrying out their mandate. Now, if you think about the South African National Park Board, they have a conservation mandate. That mandate government funds on budget for national parks to carry on that particular function, and there are a number of other institutions that I can highlight here. But essentially, our focus on reorganizing and reclassifying these institutions is making sure, for example, that the corporate forms that they adopt and choose are appropriate to the functions that they implement. So, for example, if an institution is generating most of its revenues outside government from undertaking business activities, we want to make sure that they will be taxpayers, that they are registered for VAT, that they will be registered for income tax, etc., and all of those government arrangements related to those are in place and well functioning. While those that are receiving are substantially funded from the circus, museums I'm thinking of here, are not burdened with the same responsibility in terms of managing their affairs, in terms of taxation and other governance-related issues. So governance has been a key issue in our focus here. We National Treasury has certainly been engaged with all of these departments through their own public entity units within those departments to make sure that we get better governance arrangements in these entities, that they start delivering value for money, that we get better procurement outcomes, that the reporting for these programs that they are undertaking are much more significant, and that we have improved more effective, efficient public entities. In terms of the consolidation, the DFI consolidation, the minister, when establishing this, I think the then minister noted an intention to create this human settlements development bank. And of course, in doing that, it meant that the existing functions that are performed by other DFIs, the Rural Housing Low Finance Corporation, Lurcha, and the Energy Housing Finance Corporation, would be then activities of those would be merged into them. And of course, what we are now dealing with is the process of how that would happen. They would submit a business case to the National Treasury. We have a task team that we have together with the Department of Human Settlement, and we are engaging with them in that regard. Insofar as the provincial public entities are concerned, the matters related to delisting, this work has already been done, and this will be delisted. We anticipate on the 29th of the 3rd, and the new government is there to issue. So this is just giving you an update on what's happening there. This work has already happened. The National Treasury is responsible for the process of delisting. In doing that, of course, there are a number of engagements that take place between the provinces and the National Department on those institutions that are looking to delist. This will be supported by the establishment plan, and all of those have already been engaged with, and approvals given for that. And of course, now this is the final process of delisting the entity, in other words, taking it off the schedule of entities that government has in the 6th year. So, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, only national and provincial entities are listed. Entities that operate at the municipal level are established in terms of the Municipal Systems Act, and therefore fall under a different financing arrangement and governance arrangement. So those are listed separately and not dealt with in terms of this. Jefferson, in terms of the discussions we had, value for money, honorable member raised regarding the additional information provided, the number of people that we currently have, I anticipate that the number of personnel operating in the public entity sector is in excess of 200,000, but I can confirm that number and let you have it. I didn't include it in this. We do have that information, and we'll make something or two. In relation to the consolidated government spend in terms of functional classification, there are different classifications that we have in terms of where the spending is happening. Learning and culture related to the spending that's happening, for example, in libraries and playhouses, museums, and other, and of course others are in relation to activities of training in relation to the budget that was identified. And we've broken that up in that part. Again, maybe you'll talk a bit about economics.
So first of all, just to say that part of why we provided this information, financial information, is precisely because we are concerned with the quality of the data we get, and precisely the concerns of the committee around quality of spend and so on. So, I mean, the question on learning and culture, the reason why that grows so massively is because included in learning and culture is NSFAS. And NSFAS has just been given a massive boost by the decision to improve higher education. So you'll see that the numbers ramping up about 10 billion in 1 year and then almost 10 billion again in 1920 and so on. So because what happened when we implemented free higher education, for example, was effectively that a large percentage of the cuts that were introduced on the baseline. To sum up, what happened when we cut the time of budget is that almost every department experienced very large cuts their baseline. And that in total over the next 3 years amounted to 85 billion, so about 55 to 50 billion a year of taking out of department's baseline. And of that, 57 billion went towards free higher education. So in effect what we did through that decision, and I'm not debating the merits or demerits of the decision, but from a financial perspective, what happened was we took money away from goods and services and capital, and we gave it to an entity to transfer to households, is where it's currently being from an accounting perspective, although I think that's open for debate and we're going to look at that again. So in effect, the free higher education decision put a lot more money into public entities, and it put a lot more money into consumption spending over infrastructure investment. And again, we're not debating here whether or not that was a great decision, but I think it's important to understand. So these entities are doing a lot of work and a wide range of different kinds of work. The question of what is economic development? One of the difficulties we have is how do you even present such complicated information as you've seen from hundreds of entities. But to answer the question, what is the economic function? It is basically SANRAL, PCTA, the water trading entity, the property management trading entity, and CETA. And I'm sure you're well aware that all of those have been facing severe financial difficulties recently, and there are big questions around the sustainability of the water sector and how payments there between PCTA and the water trading entity and the Department of Water are managed. And so on. So, this discussion on its own could be a multi-day workshop, because we're talking about very big, very important institutions doing crucial infrastructure spend or not, as may be the case. And really, I think the point I want to make before we close this discussion, Chair, I think it's given the time limit, but I think it's important to realize that basically two-thirds of all of this spending is done by about 10 entities. Let me be exactly clear on that. Let me just get you the numbers quickly. I think this is a very important point. If we're going to have discussions on yes, that's correct. So I think that's also very important, Chair, just to note the last bullet point on this page entitled Breakdown of Spending, that it's really a concentrated thing. So there are hundreds of entities there are hundreds of entities, but if you really want to get a grasp of what is driving the sector, 85% of spending is concentrated in the 26 largest entities. And of the top 10, two-thirds of that spending, there are 133 billion. It really is the case that it's dominated by the big entities that I've already mentioned, many of which are involved in crucial infrastructure spending. So we're saying as Treasury that we are well aware of the importance of the sector. We are also very concerned. One of the major reforms that we tried to introduce, Chair, which you picked up on, is just requiring that we have quarterly numbers coming in from these entities. And even there, it's been a struggle. We are currently getting about 80% of those entities to report on a quarterly basis, which suggests that there are also issues with data management and financial reporting. So we can continue the discussion, Chair, but there's a lot here. I hope you've given me a sense of what you mean.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the content. I really would have liked to be a second part of the information in terms of the discussion of adjustment. But if members of the have a question, we would please upload those questions in writing to the secretary or the secretary forward these to the department for the responses for the written responses to the comments.
If I may. Yeah, we're more than willing to answer any questions. We think this is a big issue and we want to make it, we want to highlight this discussion going forward in the budget documentation as well. But to maybe have that, Lily and the OCPO team, the Chief Procurement Office team, also be catching on some of these entities in their discussion. So there will be an opportunity for us to push on.
Okay, thank you very much for the interesting.
Working with within that structure to make
make sure that the recommendations can are implemented and are managed by the that committee. Coming from this conceptual document,
the cabinet memo was prepared, which then went to cabinet to authorize the establishment of the budget facility of infrastructure. The feedback that we got from cabinet on slide 2, cabinet noted the conceptual document and the progress that has been made in the establishment of the budget facility, but there was also a request that the Minister of Finance fast track the finalization of the development of the budget facility. And I think they also pointed out areas of the conceptual document that they wanted strengthened, and that this were to do broadening the scope of infrastructure build, reviewing the proposed time frames of the future phases of the budget facility on infrastructure. And some of these are issues were to do with facilitating the building of the project timeline, coming up with the multi-year authority system and the proposed expenditure account. I will also explain a little bit on this issue later on in the presentation. And then also they approved the proposals of the establishment of the budget facility for infrastructure as they were detailed in the conceptual document. So when you look at the conceptual document and what was saying on the establishment of the budget facility for infrastructure, I think the key issue was that given the characteristics of large infrastructure projects and the special capabilities that are needed in their planning, in their packaging, in their financing, in their monitoring, the current system that we have was seen as suboptimal, and there was a need to improve on it. I think the major issue with the concentration on allocating the capital cost of the project, but then the budget is not anticipating the operational cost, the maintenance cost over the lifetime of the project. And also, when it's treated in the budgeting process, the operational and maintenance costs are treated as OPEX. And yet when a project does not have the necessary operating costs, the necessary maintenance costs, they are able to solve problems. So the conceptual document does not attempt to resolve all the problems at one go, but sets out a new regional approach and focuses initially on the reforms to the budget process. So the budget facility advances some of the objective steps by cabinet, in particular the following areas. The reforms to budgeting systems that create an institutional process to support the execution of national priority projects, and the establishment of a technical unit that facilitates the appraisal and recommends large public infrastructure projects for inclusion in budget allocation and support project execution. So the budget facility is building up structures, procedures, criteria that ensure that good projects are not subject to the same fiscal constraints that affect to operating budgets, and that operating and maintenance costs are effectively addressed during our budgeting. And also coming up with a financing facility that is fully integrated into the national budgeting system, and also beginning to involve concessional lenders and providers of finance and technical assistance so that we boost the funds that are available for large priority infrastructure projects. On slide number 4, we show a diagram that depicts how the budget facility or the infrastructure is meant to work. I think on your left you see there the column with the project sponsor, where we are saying there the technical assistance for project preparation is an important aspect, but is not, and it is done by the department. I think initially the thinking is that PDD through the PICC play an important role in building a project spectrum. And I think even before the establishment of the budget facility fund has begun to be allocated to the PICC for project development, but there are also other players like the DBSA, like the project development facility in a component of the national treasury, the GTEC. So this will be responsible for the project design, preparation and planning, the socio-economic evaluation, the feasibility studies, coming up with the business cases, and the financing arrangements for the project. These would then come to the budget facility for infrastructure, and the facility is coming up with the standard criteria for appraisal, assessing whether all the life cycle cost of the project has been taken into account, and then zeroing in on the financial and fiscal programming of the project. This is then included for each and every project, a recommendation report that then comes into the budget and process now through MTEC. It goes to Minicom, but if it's approved, it's then given an allocation. And then if it doesn't meet the requirements, it's fed back into the to the project sponsor to improve on the project. So this is how the BFI process is supposed to work. But I must also say that in the concept document, there is a governance structure where we have the DGs of the department with the largest infrastructure spend give oversight on the work of the BFI. And then there's the Joint Technical Committee, which manages the day-to-day work of the BFI, which is comprised of senior officials coming from the DPME, the National Treasury, and the PICC. And within the National Treasury, there sits the Secretariat for the Budget Facility and Infrastructure. But the work on the management, the appraisal, everything is done by the Joint Technical Committee made up of senior officials of the Trade Department as delegated by Cabinet. The progress made so far in the establishment of the BFI. So, like I was indicated, we came in May and briefed the Standing Committee on Appropriations on the process, on the progress that has been made at that time. There was a call for proposals for large national priority projects, which was issued as part of the 2018-19 MTF guidelines. And in these, the criteria that was set in the call for proposal was that the project that had to come through the budget facility for infrastructure would be national priority project as designated by the PICC. And they would also be large in terms of their financial implications and also in terms of their broad economic implications over the whole country, and that they had to be ready for implementation during the 18-19 financial year. So as a result of that call for proposals, we got 64 projects worth about 138 billion that were submitted. And then the Joint Technical Committee met and put in place structures, processes, and criteria for the appraisal and evaluation of this project. The projects were then sifted, and out of these, a few projects met the criteria, and this went through the detailed appraisal. Going on to slide number 6. Honorable members, like I said, out of the 64 projects, the projects that came through were the construction of new and refurbishment of major streets and high courts. There was also the Bukoko Central Hospital. There were also development corridor rapid rail projects. Cape Town Metro Southeast, this is the bus rapid rail system here. And then the Umbuku Water Project, There were also 31 projects, 31 water projects that we submitted, some coming through the water treatment entity and some coming from the regional power infrastructure grant. And then the broadband, the South Africa Connect Phase 2 project. So these were the projects that the Joint Technical Committee decided that they met the criteria and they go through the detailed evaluation. I must also say that we received the project from higher education on the school's accommodation. But that project, what they said was that the feasibility study was divided in November. And the Joint Technical Committee said that whenever the feasibility study was completed, they should submit it back. But up to now, it hasn't been submitted. But the Joint Technical Committee said the letter should be returned to them to try and push the process because of the strategic importance of the project. Now, when we look at the results that came out, we find that only really one project met the criteria. And some of the projects, but there are also some potentially viable projects that were not properly passed, and that there's still work that needs to be done to bring them to a stage where they can be considered for funding. So the only project that came through was Cape Town Metro House, which kind of ticked all the boxes. But we also see that there were projects such as the Limpopo Central Hospital, which can really be fast-tracked, as well as the South Africa Connect Phase 2, where work can be done to try and package it properly and fast-track it. And the technical committee made the decision that this should be considered for funding during the adjustment budget in October. We just highlighted some learning points from the technical appraisal process. And I think the learning points that we're coming through is that there is insufficient technical expertise and institutional capacity to develop good projects. And that project selection is frequently driven by the appeal of solutions promoted by sponsors rather than being very critical and open-minded to solve a public political problem. I think we see that mostly when you look at Limpopo, for example, when you look at Moloto, for example, where there is a special problem, there is an economic development problem, there is a transport problem, but the project only addresses the transport problem, and we see that the resolution of a public policy problem is not being addressed properly. Also, the cost-benefit analysis are not being undertaken in a rigorous or standardized manner. I think what you see is that when you look at, for example, you do a distributive analysis to say, these are the beneficiaries of the project, and these are the costs. When you look at who gains from the project, who loses, you then find that the problem is identified and it's objective. And when you look at the solution, there isn't a link between the two. And then insufficient attention is given to life cycle costing of projects to ensure that long-term budget commitments are effectively anticipated. For example, when we look at the Limpopo Central Hospital, we find that the way it has been structured is that the life cycle cost, the operational cost, is not to be considered. They've just zeroed in on the capital cost. But once it's completed, how are you going to run it and maintain it? So these are the issues that we are saying need to be addressed quickly as the project to be packaged. Costs are poorly estimated and design features are both places rather than tailored towards affordability. Therefore, we are saying we are operating in a constrained environment. You don't want a technically expensive solution. So we have an example here where we are saying where a BMW is given, when a Toyota will do. So this is what we are talking about in the project. And that also project sponsors lack the capacity. implementation and management. And I think what comes clear is that problems become apparent when financial commitments are required, creating the impression that finance rather than planning is an issue. So we need to balance this. And then when the JTC had completed the recommendations on each report, they were sent to MTEC. MTEC made their comments, and these were then sent, the report were then sent to the Minister's Committee on the Budget. And the Minister's Committee on the Budget also made their observations and comments. And I would just highlight this because I think they are very important to the continual improvement of the budget facility or infrastructure. So these were some of the issues noted by the Minister's Committee on the Budget. The agency to resolve the issues raised in the technical assessment process. That it is also important to articulate the criteria used within the DFI project. The criteria should not only consider technical issues, but should also consider other priorities, such as economic growth and social equity. And also that the large infrastructure projects list approved by cabinet, it should be seen coming through the DFI process, and that mechanisms should be put in place to give departments the technical expertise required to plan and package projects quickly, and also to support to fast-track viable projects. I think some of the issues also were to do with the building of a project pipeline, the formation of the National Treasury Project Finance Account. Here what we are saying is that the conceptual document says that there should be a project account that is formed so that when we allocate money to an infrastructure project, let's say it's POPO, it's housed in that project account. Because say it's spending over 7 years, but our MTF process only covers 3 years, but the project is spending over 7 years. So we make sure that the money for the capital spending, the money for the operational expenditure is housed and dedicated to the project. But this must also be accompanied with the authority to spend law for large projects. So here what we are saying is, often you see that funds allocated to a project must be dedicated to the use of that project and not be diverted anyway. Therefore, the multi-year authority to spend would then lay out all the details on how the department will be spending, how it will be reporting, how we will manage any cost overrun of the project over its life cycle, and they will be reporting to Parliament through this multi-year authority to spend, bearing in mind that these are huge projects where some of them running into 50 billion or so. So it's very important that this national project finance account, as well as the authority to spend bill, this still needs to be worked out. Adequate provision should also be made for financial resources to cover current and future costs of projects, preparation and related administrative costs. And Dominic Combat also highlighted the need to communicate quickly to the sponsoring departments the outcomes of the evaluation. And then we look at the developments that then arose from the budget review 2018, this last February. So, to ensure the institutionalization and further development of the DFI and to take forward the recommendations on each project, the following actions were taken. The budget process made a provisional allocation to viable projects coming out of the DFI pipeline, and the allocations to projects need to be made in the adjustment budget in October 2018. So this was a very good development in that what is coming out now is there is a provision for the funding of the pipeline. Additional work needs to be done to ensure proposals are ready to be considered for funding. Now this is the Joint Technical Committee really needs to work hard to make sure that all the proposals that have potential to be funded are ready. by before the adjustment budget so that they go through the proper budgeting process. There was also this that the facility to be used to explore funding options with development finance institutions in the private sector. And then also to give DFI legitimate, they need to build the pipeline project. They need to urgently put in place again the mechanism to fast track the potentially viable projects. But I think there was also a recognition that this is a comprehensive reform which needs to be better resourced in terms of institutional capacity. And then looking forward in the rollout of the budget facility on infrastructure, currently the finalization of the 2017-18 cycle sits with the department on the outcome of the DFI process and addressing issues raised in the technical phase of process and then providing the capacity and skills to fast track the project and provide guidance on how now department will make submissions to the adjustment budget process in October 2018. And then also taking into account the comments from cabinet and also from the minister's comments on the budget, on the further development of the DFI, strengthening the conceptual document in line with the comments that were provided, trying to bring forward the time frame for the future phases of the project, and developing the next phases, such as the multi-year authority to spend, the formation of the National Treasury Project account. And on the last slide, the initiating the 2018 DFI cycle, according to the minutes of the last meeting of the Joint Technical Committee, we should be issuing the four proposals by end of March this year, and we should be putting in place mechanisms to assist project sponsors with the expertise required to package projects quickly. And there's also the development of the government-wide project appraisal and evaluation guidelines, because departments struggle with how do we really package. So we are developing this government-wide project appraisal and evaluation guidelines that will be issued as a regulation by the National Treasury. And maybe in closing, I would also say that we have built experiences, for example, with the World Cup, how we fast-tracked the project, and we are testing on this experience and the people who have worked on those projects to help us in fast-tracking some of the DFI projects that is with the potential to be funded during the October 2018 assessment. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member. I would be happy to take any questions related to the DFI.
I'll just very briefly, just to sum up, I think the important points that Dorf has made are firstly that in the process of receiving a lot of proposals, the difficulty that the government faces is that it's very difficult to put together a complicated infrastructure project proposal. And the general departments don't have the skills to do so. And so even where we saw projects that could potentially be good projects, they often didn't comply. And so what we're trying to do now is take those which have have evidence of being a good project but don't yet tick the boxes of the BFI and get those up to speed and ensure that all those boxes are ticked before they are considered for funding. But in general, this is a very complicated reform, and I think it's fair to say, we are also finding our way at the moment, and I think the real work is going to be around the legal implications of these long-term authority to spend bill and so on, and also slowly bringing in development finance institutions and others. So there's been a lot of work done, and we've tried as far as possible to ensure that it's across different departments that uses expertise from different departments, and in some cases assistance from specialists in the area of transport or water and so on. But the real issue is that the partners tend to rely a lot on consultants to write proposals for large infrastructure without necessarily understanding the implications thereof. And I think the challenge of the is how to capacitate the partners to be able to provide the information you need to make decisions on very complicated and sometimes long-term projects.
I think the higher risk in all this is healthcare. That is the higher risk. So which means government will then have to find a way of addressing this. Otherwise, we continue to understand in the infrastructure budget, and we continue to suffer budget cuts. Blame government for budget cuts when actually we ourselves were failed to deliver on the budget that was allocated. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I'm now opening the floor for clarity sitting questions, but also we can go have a discussion. Honourable member Mafamani and Honourable member McLaughlin, Honourable member any other hands? Please put in hands. So the three hands now, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. And welcome the presentation. I think the thing that the project on the student accommodation will come late. Not yet. It will come in November. And that I didn't think it clear. But this is very important to check with you. I've got two children at the university. If you are a parent, you will understand what it means. Of course, my children don't qualify for next one. Because I work here in Parliament. So my salary bracket is excluded. But they stay in a private accommodation as I speak. This is a method that must be accepted. I can afford, I'm a member of Parliament. I earn more than 750,000. But for a parent who stays from Kwamhlawe, England, who struggles to bring a child to the University of Pretoria, and the next thing, there's no accommodation around the campus. The child ends up staying very far from the campus. It disadvantages the poor children in terms of studying. It's also not safe for girls children. A lot of problems with the female students who stay far away from campuses and so on, the list and so on and so on. Today, as far as accredited lots of privately owned facilities, I know the University of Denver, I'm studying there. So much mushrooming of private accommodation around those facilities accredited by NSFAS. And transport becomes a problem. So let this matter be structured. I'm speaking from a point of understanding what it means, and let the Department of Higher Education be assisted. I think the problem is when Department of Education wants to do a public works function. The Department of Higher Education is responsible for higher education, not to build the built infrastructure. You see, this thing of demobilizing certain departments which were established for particular purposes is wrong. Public works has been established to be responsible for public property. and it has got expertise to do this work. I know this chairperson is not taking long. When I was in the Popo government, the Department of Education established an engineering unit to build schools themselves, and which was wrong, and no longer started to work with public work. And there were so many problems. There was the child in the school and the teacher. But the moment they started to focus on building schools, it created a lot of problems. And the same happened with the Department of Health when I was there. So these are issues that must be properly discussed. Establishment of this facility, I hope, does not mean demobilizing departments which were created specifically to do certain functions. Transport is responsible for all. I hope we are not going to take transport work. So on and so on and so on. So there has to be a clear definition of what we intend to do. Because we might do something, but it achieves unintended consequences. And those departments which are there solely responsible for those functions, they were sidelined. What should we have done? Because we have appointed, we have got engineers, the rest of them, so on and so on. World Cup experience is one thing, but it frustrates infrastructure rollout. But there were many challenges which we are dealing with today. Collusion. Why we have got a problem of ETOS, which is called GIFI, is because of collusion, chapter. Yes, we know very well it's a problem. Even Competition Commission today, as we speak, is investigating GIFI ETOS. The manner they were procured was not proper. And look, then the next thing, the contractors balloon everything to be where we are today. And the same with the stadium, there was collusion. Five or so companies built the stadium. Here is Greenpoint Stadium. What do you do with it? It's more than 5 billion now. Nobody is playing there. You have to wait to come for an artist from America to perform with them at the stadium is full. So, I think Treasury should look at the good and the bad of 2010. From an expenditure point of view, 2010 has costed the country a lot of money that should have been spent. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the intervention.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yes, I welcome this budget in terms of infrastructure. Infrastructure obviously promotes economic growth. Economic growth means jobs, more jobs means more economic growth. So it's essential, and we need this. But I have some serious concerns about, again, what I read here, because a lot of what we're doing is we're planning to plan. And we've been planning to plan for 24 years, and we're still planning to plan, because we still don't seem to have the fundamental ability to plan properly, for whatever reason. It's mentioned here several times, the lack of capacity, the technical capabilities is there. Have we got any plans in place to ensure that these plans produce a result, rather than just produce yet another plan? It's a major concern I have, because we spend so much money on it and we don't achieve the object. So we waste a lot of money going through planning and consulting and everything else, and all we end up with is a fancy plan that somebody else then has a look at and says, well, I've no idea how to implement this plan, because it's just a nice fancy plan. It's cost us R3 million and we have a nice plan where to from here. So I really would ask if we look very carefully at that idea of how do we actually implement this. Once we've gone through this whole thing, I'm keenly aware of the more than 1 year kind of spending flow, because often these projects are big. They're going to take you 5, 10, 15 years. you need to have a plan in advance to spend the over that period. So I welcome that. I'm interested to see what kind of changes in the law we're going to bring about to achieve that, because obviously that needs to be carefully managed as well, because of the obviously money decreases in value all the time, prices of things change, etc., etc. So it's going to have to be fairly fluid, because you can't decide now what a thing is going to cost you in 10 years' time. You're going to have to find some way of managing that. I was concerned, as you mentioned as well, only one project met the criteria, which I thought is the indication of what I'm saying. That the whole planning thing is problematic. I would like you just to tell us what you actually mean by a building of a project pipeline. I mean, obviously you're not talking about a physical pipe that project's going to be I want to know what you mean. What do you envisage by building a project pipeline? It's a nice expression, but it sort of gets the imagination going, but I'm not quite sure what you mean by it.
I would like to my first question based on slide 1, bullet number 2, linked to slide 3, the second last bullet. I do not quite hear and think it's clear how this budget facility for infrastructure is linked to the national budget that is announced in February. But as quickly, it's the second time that I raised this question, it seems to be some structure floating or over somewhere in the air. I mean, the real budget announced in February. So where is it? The second question is on slide 2 to 4. If you could explain just that last, that line that is broadening the scope of infrastructure. And my next question is on the last bullet on slide 3. Stronger involvement of conventional lenders as providers of financial and technical assistance. You explain this. You borrow money, finance infrastructure from the lenders, fair and square, understandable. And then you use their technical assistance. So you borrow money. You then use their skills and you pay them the same money you borrow from them. So they have a double bias to the money that you borrow. Sounds the same like, you know, the international aid fund that comes to Africa. developing countries. Almost 80% of that money called the same fund goes back to those who paid for it with their escorts. Same as the IMF, that borrows the money. And the large chunk of it goes back to the IMF because it then gives you the financial assistance, the technical assistance from itself. The borrower gives you the financial and the technical assistance, so you need that same money to pay them, and then you return their money to the future. So get this clear to us. Let it be clear, because otherwise you are telling us a problem. I'm also equally worried, Honorable Jackson, about only one project that can continue. I mean, the, for instance, the Molotov corridor has been there for some time. And it's only now that you find it's not next successful. What exactly is what? What has been being done in the project up to now? And the spend that has been going on in the project. Explain also this improvement work. Is it now going to finally get it? Because it's been there for years. And of course, whether the problem related to that project itself are now being resolved. My last question. It leads to what about government, departments, or institutions which have capacity. There are SOEs which are linked to the development of economic infrastructure in particular. We don't hear anything about them and their involvement. And they have the money, they have the capacity. Technical capacity, they can assist departments who are linked to them, etc. We don't hear anything about them, like the Zambia. And then as a result, the likes of Transnet, for instance, Caltrans, and so forth, are simply doing their own things, or doing nothing. But they have the financial capacity, they have the technical capacity, and there is nothing to say about them, they are involved. Please explain.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chen, and thank you for the presentation. I think we really do welcome the fact that something is being done around the challenges of infrastructure. As we say, we call it fair investment in the challenges across the country, even when the budget has been removed. But at the same time, we ask ourselves, what options do we have? Because one of the challenges we have is that it's not uncommon for infrastructure projects to lie there and not get completed, and which takes me to another clear question that I wanted to ask as to the involvement of other civil governments, because we find that in some instances the problems is an international project and it's not getting finished for different reasons. We do have lots of historical challenges of infrastructure, particularly from our past history. And like schools where we have tiny little classrooms, as I mentioned, a certain number, and we have challenges. Those I'm just mentioning by the way, but I think we really have a challenge, and I'm hoping that this will help us. But one of the questions actually was already answered, which my colleagues also have asked, complying department. So I won't be asking them, but I really had that question also. Now, the issue of capacity really is the department. how long does it take for this department to actually identify, besides upcoming this target that we need to infrastructure? I mean, it's been so long, and one would expect that there should have been some improvement by now. Capacity, one of the obvious indicators is always changing the capacitation of department versus appointment of consultants. There's been so little progress in this area that one just wonders what exactly the department is doing. As my colleague has mentioned, the issue of state enterprises, state-owned enterprises as a possibility, but just the department themselves, I think it's a serious problem that we have to deal with. So, yeah, but let me just end there. Because mine is more around the comments made by the president of the other state of government and where they come into the situation.
All right, to the leader of this delegation, Mr. Tuat.
Okay, thank you.
I'm just addressing you.
Mm.
You know, I think the first recommendation for establishment of this facility was in 2016 and said the implementation was in 2017. Mm-hmm. Now, what I want to find out from you, when was this approved, this facility approved? So 2017 is one. Mm-hmm. We are on the tail end of 2017 from going to 20, which means there has been a postponement of the implementation of the facility after you pronounced the implementation for 2017. Okay. When was it approved? Okay. And in terms of presentation, 64 projects at 188.6 million, which means that money available and been put aside. That's the other thing I have. 64 at 136, unless it is that money was available, submitted for 2018-19. Okay. And then of the 64, 7 were recommended for technical assistance. Only 7, imagine. And this is one pillar of the NDP that is supposed to assist this country in the creation of jobs, in the bridging of the inequality that is the end of induction of poverty. But 7 out of 64, all right? We have a problem with that. We have a serious problem with that. Okay. And then only one, everybody has alluded to it, Mr. Masonani, Mr. Tobaza, they also raised an issue with one that met the criteria. Which one is this one? Because we want to monitor it closely. Mm-hmm. And it's only one. But there's a possibility it is not closely monitored, that even this one is not difficult. Which one is this one? Okay, and then you then say there is a plan in place to fast track this project. Which project? Are you talking to the 7 or to the remainder after we fast track one? Which one? Okay, there's a plan in place for funding in the adjustment budget 2018. Let me tell you something. Now, we want, if we can get the plan, the plans. I don't know which plans are you talking about. Because plans will be time bound, specific, they will be time bound, and they will have the budget. So we would like to say there is a plan. Promise me. October is not far. October is not far. It means the plan, it should be plans that were developed in the previous financial year. Now you have the plan. Not to say it's still going to. So that you can, but also if the other worry comes from a budget that is implemented during the adjustment,
what do you say about the budget performance? The budget that was for the first time to be implemented during the adjustment of the budget. And we know that budget itself is a budget for the financial year. So now this one, you say it will be, the implementation will start during the adjustment period. It doesn't make sense. It's not helping us. I don't know the thinking here. I don't know. There's desperation. I don't remember that one, I'm saying. Student accommodation. Now, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa said we're going to be responsive to the need. You know, the President announced a fee-free education. What is that saying to you? Because the plan here, the infrastructure plan, was supposed to be aligned to that. Fee-free, can you imagine? The investors are going to be targeted by children from poor family situations. They will not be able to afford accommodation. But from the previous experience, we learned that students were already accommodated in one room. We find 14 sitting in one room. This is the previous experience when I was in the other team. So it means we have not had this noise or this need. And we've heard that some children convert themselves into prostitutes just to find money because they are from far away. But you have not had this noise. This need. So sensitive. And then they say it's not prioritized. I promise you it would be very wrong for you not to respond to this need. There's a pronouncement by the highest office in South Africa. C3. It comes when there was already a problem, the accommodation problem. But as you come in, you still don't see this and there's this. You don't see this. It will be very wrong for us to say proceed with this without prioritizing the student accommodation. It will be very, very wrong. And no one will understand the trend of thinking behind. What a trend. So I think that one should also be addressed. We will then hand over to you to respond. The plan, you must tell us about the way that you want to receive it as soon as you're ready. Because this is the plan that we're going to use to measure the performance. Remember, we want to see the expenditure on infrastructure development because we believe NTT says this is key towards addressing the troika challenges of this country. What about you?
Thank you. I think Honorable Member has raised really certain issues, and I think it's very important that these issues are adequately addressed during the development of the budget facility for infrastructure. I think the chair has indicated the importance of ensuring that we bridge the skills gap.
And Madam, if I may, just a short question.
Okay.
And on our side.
And avoid understanding. So I think I will just, I think suitable accommodation has been raised by honorable members across. With student accommodation, everyone is concerned that this is a priority project. But I think the honorable member was also talking about the roles of the department and the roles of the DFI. The DFI cannot take the role which is played by the Department of Higher Education. They put in an application indicated that the feasibility study will be completed in November. We wrote back, recognized the need, and asked them to submit back as soon as possible. The department has not responded as yet. The Joint Technical Committee has also made exactly the comments that have been made here, that we need to expedite this process, and we have written again to them to say we need this project to come back so it can be considered quickly together with the other projects. But perhaps there is need for the Joint Technical Committee to really then maybe
have a meeting with the department to identify what is wrong and maybe for the PICC to interview also, and there might be need for some hand-holding that needs to be done. And I think this is speaking maybe to the plan that we have. The plan that we have is that we embrace the issues per project that need to be addressed. And we have lead assessors who are leading in the assessment of each project. So for each project, there is a way forward with milestones that need to be achieved. And there is a task team on each project that is working in addressing the shortcomings that have been identified in most of these projects. Yes, the World Cup experience. I think, like you said, we are very aware of the problems that the shortcomings, the good things, the bad points of what happened with the World Cup. But what we are saying is that they need to be an intervention, and I think maybe that's what the chair is talking about, a concrete intervention that begins to push through the project so that they are ready. I think this thing about building capacity for infrastructure projects, I think the problem is that when we look at project planning, project appraisal, project implementation, these are specialized skills which are not readily resident in the country, although they have the infrastructure responsibility. This is why we have the PIT tasked with the job of unblocking, of facilitating, of helping departments. And what we are saying, I think the JTC has said, we have to look at whether the money that has been allocated to the PIC to do that job adequately, we have given them sufficient resources to then do this. They are also, I think, Ian has said, we are learning as we are going. And I think the PIC is also learning and playing this important role. There was also the question about what is the pipeline, what is the pipeline of projects. What we mean is when we have good, viable projects that have been appraised and we put them in a pool, come by the process, we have got these projects which are good, which are viable, they are in a pool, we prioritize and say, as government, out of the projects which are readily which are ready for implementation, let's prioritize them. That is the pipeline we are trying to build. And the CAA says that now what you see is that we have the BFI, but we only have 7 projects that came through. And out of those 7, not even all of them are ready, so we don't have that pipeline. So what we say by pipeline is building a pool of projects that are ready for funding so that as government we can prioritize and say these projects go with our priorities, they are ready, we can allocate money, they can hit the ground running, they are shovel ready, we can start their implementation. How is the DFI linked to the national budget review? Where is the link? I think what we are saying, I think cabinet right from the start has indicated that this BFI must be strongly linked to the budget process. So what happened is that the preparation, the appraisal of projects should be year-round, and those projects which are ready should slide into the budgeting process. Ideally, this is what should happen. So what we did this year, because it was our first run on the BFI, was to say when we finished the appraisal process, the budget process already was ahead, the MTEC process was ahead of us. So what we then did was to hold a special MTEC process to consider the recommendations from the CSI. And these were then fed into the Minister's Committee on the Budget. And this comment was then taken on by Budget Review 2018. So this is what happened. So it was dealing in any way. The budgeting of projects should be done within the normal cost of budgeting. And that is why also we are saying that this expenditure law to spend on major projects must also go through the due process, go through parliament, so that we are aware of what is happening with the budgeting of this project. This is very important because when you look, for example, in projects like Limpopo with high operational costs, it's very important that we know how they are spent and whether they are adequately resourced to run hospitals like that. The question on professional financing and what it means. What you are saying is that we have got a constrained system. And what we are saying is that if we are to break the spending ceiling, for example, it must be for a good thing. And what we are saying is if we don't have the money and we go out and borrow, it must be a professional advice. That means that if government were to go out and borrow for the project, when we talk of concessionary funding, it must come lower than the government's rate of borrowing. That's what makes it concessional. And what we are saying is that there's a lot of expertise sitting with these concessionary lenders because they have put funding that they have, which they use, for example, take the DBSA, for example. They've got the fund that they have that helps in the packaging and preparation of projects. But when they do that, they also then say they have the first right to fund that project because they would have given this grant money for the development of the project. So it's how you work out and package it that the recipe they are charging should be concessionary below government rent. And two, they should get a separate school that comes in grant funding for the technical expertise, and then you can borrow from yourself for the capital cost of your project. Let me just maybe briefly run on the project that came through and why only one project came through. So what we were saying is that we had a criteria. The broad criteria was that it must be a national priority, it must be large financial implications and economic impact on the economy, and it must be ready for funding. That was the criteria. So the 64 projects that came through, when we looked at the money they were looking for, it was coming up to that 1.8 billion. So it was just the application that they came through and the number of projects that came through. And then we tested them with the criteria. And then out of the criteria, these are the seven are the projects that meet that broad criteria. And then after that, we were then going now inside the project to say, let's look at the needs analysis. Let's look at the objectives of the project. Let's look at the options. Someone talked about the options for their implementation. Let's look at how they have looked at the different options, different needs, the same needs. Let's look at the socio-economic impact, the economic impact of the project. Let's also look at the risk that is in the project. Let's see whether...
Okay.
Well, it's important because you then see that when we come, for example, to Umbuzi, you see that there were certain prerequisites. They said this has to be in place, this has to be in place, this has to be in place for this project to apply. And those prerequisites are not there. When you look at the options, you then find that the option, they only considered one option. And so there were issues to do with each problem, which are detailed in each of the appraisals. So the same with Moloto. When you develop, it's a corridor development solution that is required.
And if I may guide you, we've heard about the criteria. We have the seven. Which one is the one that is meeting the criteria?
So the one that has met the criteria outright is the capital measure of Southeast. And then we have been talking with the policy so that the issues that are related to people address. And then there's also South Africa,
as a project process. So those were the first decisions, between subjects and between the dangerous for the other things. With regard to the other projects, there are recommendations on reporting and putting money for planning and facilitating them. So I would say roughly this is the plan that is there. And like I said, we have got a task team which are being led by the assistants which are running the process of partly packaging the process.
Exactly. So the purpose of this
I hear your frustration, and the purpose of this report was to ask, well, how can you avoid a situation in which you keep giving money to large infrastructure projects and then you've not spent? And the answer is, well, you have to plan more carefully around it. Now, there seems to be quite a bit of confusion, and I think we should, as Treasury, we need to improve the way in which we communicate around it. What we've proposed is a budgeting process to try to improve the quality of the submissions we get on infrastructure so that we can decide on a reasonable basis whether or not to put additional money into infrastructure in addition to what you've seen. The request that we put out, in my view, is absolutely standard and reasonable in terms of the requirements of the submissions, that there's a description of the program, a justification, objective, a summary of other options, a budget statement, risks, procurement plan. This is absolutely standard. The fact that large projects are being sent to Treasury to consider funding without those basic project management steps being followed is highly problematic. So I think it's important that to make this clear. We are trying to improve the quality and reduce underspending and reduce wastage on infrastructure, which, as you rightly pointed out, is a major problem, by asking that the most basic element of project management are followed in asking for funding for very large infrastructure projects. I mean, part of why so many of these projects didn't make it through, if I may, the book is because they didn't even qualify for the criteria that we put out here. In terms of it being large infrastructure, some of these are very small water infrastructure projects. Just help me out here, if you disagree, of which had already been put forward in previous MTECs. What we were asking for is that departments who want to do mega infrastructure projects come to the national budgeting process with a reasonable and comprehensive set of explanations about what needs to get done and how it's going to be done, and more importantly, who's going to pay for it and who's going to pay for the operations, so that we don't build an academic hospital in Limpopo that has no staff and no money for medicines and so on. This is absolutely standard project infrastructure management requirements that we put forward, and the vast majority of these projects don't comply. And I understand the frustration, but on the other hand, the fact that, for example, the Department of Higher Education doesn't come back on the proposal on student housing and so on, I think speaks to a more general issue about why is government not pushing infrastructure projects in the way that it should. And, we're not talking state owned companies here. I think there was some misunderstanding. This is about the national budget. State owned companies have their own balance sheet they borrow to build. And as we know, the state owned companies also have large problems with their infrastructure build program. But this is a process to try to get a better quality of infrastructure bid for large infrastructure projects. And no more, no less. Thank you.
You see, your government,
and this SOE are state-owned enterprises. They're not flying institutions on their own, independent and unconnected altogether. That's the first thing. So they cannot be deemed from this huge infrastructure they pay for. That's it. Secondly, you use every technical assistance that you can get from internally, from your own, and your own are state-owned enterprises. Now, it's something else that you complain about lack of technical capacity. Like one of what you were saying, don't destroy that something that is there, use it, and where it has been undone, and now we realize that we made a mistake, put it back so that it helps the state to move forward with this thing.
Mr.
Mandate and the terms of reference of BSMI
should be clearly spelled out. Because it has got a danger to become a structure which has got veto powers on structures that have got their own original executive powers. And that is going to create a problem. Censorship.
All right, thank you so much. I think it helped us to close this up. So you all have another day. And I hope you let me talk to all those issues that have been raised so that we can, we want to assist, because as whatever departments are not together, you know, the other hand is sitting at every point like this is come from us. This is say, what have we done to make sure that
Agreed.
Let's take the payment within 30 days. And he said it's not long, and you do not read every sentence, but you talk to him. And then we allow OCP O to come in.
Thank you, Chairperson, for me to have the first. Okay, the first slide 2 and slide 3 are just basically the legislative requirements that that compels institutions to make to ensure that their payments are made within 30 days. And Chairperson, to come back to your comment about the minister's absence at the junior budget speech. There has been a circular that was issued yesterday. It was signed off by the Director General and was forwarded to all departments, to all PFMA compliant institutions, and as well as to municipalities. So that has been done.
I've got it here on the system. I can give it to Mr.
Kamala has got the electronic version of the presentation.
Of the circular.
Okay, and then, in terms of the National Treasury instruction note number 34 that was issued in 2011, there's certain information that PFMA compliance, so basically departments are required to forward to the National Treasury. And this is basically on the information that they are required to send. And we compiled, the Office of the Council General compiles a detailed report and submits that to FOSSAT on a quarterly basis. Initially it was submitted bi-monthly, but we agreed with the chair of FOSSAT that we'd present the information on a quarterly basis. And this is basically the information that is set. But I think your interest here was basically the status of payment suppliers per budget board. So if we can go to slide 4. This tells us about the invoices that have been paid after 30 days for the period. Now this is the analysis for the period July 2017 to December 2017. And you notice from the first few departments, starting from environmental affairs, going on to trade and industry, there's no invoices that have been paid after 30 days, so basically they have been paying their invoices timelessly. But thereafter, if you look from agriculture downwards, on this particular page, you'd see that, it would be correctional services that in terms of rand value have paid invoices after 30 days, amount to almost R1 billion. So, and that was in terms of the number of invoices was 5,097. But if you look at the number of invoices, if you look at the Department of Defense, in terms of the number of invoices, it's almost 40,000 invoices that were paid after 30 days to the rand value of about R395 million. Then if you look at the next page, on page 5, here you see the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in terms of the number of value of invoices about R383 million, and about basically 6,810 invoices were paid after 30 days, whereas the Department of Public Works and the Property Management Trading Entity the number of invoices paid after 30 days was 15,578 to the rand value of about R18 million. Then the slide 6, where invoices that were older than 30 days and which remain unpaid, you find this slide, all these departments that are listed here have indicated that they have not paid invoice in the 30 days. But I must emphasize, Chairperson and honourable members, the information that I present to you is as presented to the National Treasury by the partners. Then on slide 7, these are the invoices that are older than 30 days and remain unpaid. And if you look at the here, it's the, once again, Public Works and Property Management Trading Entity. It has 10,788 invoices to the rand value of 5 million rand. Whereas the Department of Water and Sanitation is just 169 invoices that remain unpaid, but here the rand value is 104 million rand. If we can go to the provinces, the number of invoices paid after 30 days here, you'd see the Gauteng is 46,235 invoices amounting to 4 billion rand. And here it's mainly the Department of Health, and it's because of the the medical legal claims against the state for negligence. And then if you look at the next slide on the invoices older than 30 days which were not paid, it's also once again Gauteng with 48,643 invoices that were not paid, that remain unpaid, and this is closer to 3 billion rand worth of those invoices. Yeah, and this is the sectoral analysis, and you see that it is mainly the health and the education departments. When we did the analysis, we found that in excess of 90% of the invoices were basically linked to the Department of Education and the Department of Health. Yeah. And then the next slide is the percentage of invoices are older than 30 days and which have not been paid. And here, once again, you can see it's mainly the health and education departments. Small amounts of public works and the other departments is quite insignificant. Yeah. Then, honourable members, there was a cabinet decision that the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation established a unit to follow up on entities that are not complying with the prescript to pay the invoices timelessly. So the DPME took the lead in that, and it was joined by the National Treasury, Small Business Development and DTI, and the purpose of forming a task team was to meet the departments to identify what were the problems that they were facing, as well as to offer some solutions as to how they can improve their payments. Now, the departments that were visited were Defence, Home Affairs, Water and Sanitation, and Public Works. Now, the common challenges that were faced by departments were basically some of them, especially the Department of Defence, spoke about the legacy system not producing reliable information, administrative processes, basically some bureaucracy, then procurement and contract management, the no effective contract management. Many departments didn't have an invoice tracking system. There was departments like Home Affairs and so forth. They have they are highly decentralized. So there's no essential point to the receiving of invoices. But what we have found that, all the others were quite insignificant compared to the budgetary constraints that these departments face. And many of them, you'd find, again, financially, this large accrual, they wait for the new tranche of money in order to make payment, to settle the invoices in respect of the previous financial year. And then also, there were challenges with regards to the internal control processes and also the lack of consequence management. You know, the Auditor General annually, in the general report on audit outcomes, speaks about the lack of consequence management. So in cases where there's lack of initiative of employees to ensure that that their work is done timely, but nothing really happened. So it just the problem just perpetuated. Now, Tutaskin was also visited the provincial departments, and these are the departments that were visited: Gauteng Health, Education, Community Safety, Mpumalanga Education, and Public Works, Roads and Transport. And here as well, the challenges were similar to those of the national departments. I mean, they have budget sequence change, high volume of accruals, and yet some of them spoke about manual orders and sundry payments. A Department of Health, medical negligence claim investigation, and some of them claim of unfunded mandates. And then you talk about cross-border patients, especially in the Mpumalanga Department of Health. They often, they get people coming in from Swaziland, from Mozambique, and so forth. And this also has an impact on their budget, because they need to treat patients that are ill. Here as well, there's contract management difficulties and delay in the verification of projects. And here as well, you see that the reasons for the non-payment of invoices. As I indicated, they have budgetary constraints, so there's insufficient cash flows, large amounts of growth. Once again, inadequate internal controls, lack of effective invoice tracking system, whether manual or electronic. There's no delegations of proper delegations of authority. So the person, one person is that has the power to approve invoices is not available, then just wait until the person comes back from leave or from whatever. And then there's also, there's no centralized payment processes, large amount of accruals, high amount of litigation, especially in the health environment, and once again, also lack of consequence management. Then, the impact that this has on suppliers, we as government, on one hand, we have the National Growth Plan, the National Development Plan, and so forth, all with the intention of creating jobs and especially the SMMEs. But then on the other hand, if government doesn't pay their suppliers on time, this has a severe impact on their sustainability. And this results in suppliers often needing to borrow money in order to meet contractual obligations. In some cases, they even retrench their employees just to ensure that they are able to keep their heads above water. Now, as I said, this is counterproductive towards government initiatives. Then, as much as they have, suppliers have not mentioned this to us when we did meet suppliers to an initiative, to a public service commission, there were instances, suppliers called into the talk radio, an indication that there's also a corruption factor that delays the payment of invoices, where invoices sit in the drawer of an employee, and then they need to be paid a facilitation fee to take those invoices out. Also, the suppliers have not mentioned any names, but then this is also a reality. And then, by government not paying the suppliers timelessly, it's a huge reputational risk to a government. Now, in terms of interventions, accounting officers must start taking this, where there's, delays where there's no budgetary implications, where they're not delayed payments because of budget. Accounting officers need to start taking disciplinary steps against officials. And then they also need to analyze the reasons for delays in the payments. And then to act on those against employees. Then the payments within 30 days must be a standing item at all exports. The National Treasury, basically the Office of Accounting General, submits a memorandum to Cabinet each year on timeous tabling of annual reports, as well as on the audit outcomes of institutions. And there as well, you find that there's issues around the payments within 30 days. And one of the recommendations that we made in cabinet resolved that you know, these payments within 30 days must form part of the performance agreement of accounting officers. But you know, whether it happens, we really don't know. Or even if it does happen, you know, whether it's being really policed and whether you know, discipline steps are taken against accounting officers. Then also, suppliers, if you don't pay your invoices on time, there's interest, and then interest still needs to be paid to the suppliers, but then those things must be disallowed and must be recovered from the relevant official. So then you know, that at least there'll be some sanctions as part of the sanction. So if we don't start implementing consequence management, effective consequence management in departments or in all PFMA compliant institutions, then we're really not going to win this battle against the delayed payments. But I think also we just need to recognize that some of the institutions definitely do face budgetary constraints. And there are also, as I said, there's a corruption factor and there's also the lack of initiative on the part of some employees that result in delayed payments. But then it's also, you know, it comes down to leadership as well. And I think in one of the Gauteng departments, I mean, they pay within the, I think the Gauteng Department of Economic Development, I mean, that MEC, when he took office, he said that department will pay the invoice within 15 days. And it really happens. The same with the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. I mean, they lead it by example, and they as well. Within 15 days, when I spoke to the CFO, and that's also from the information that we received, between 15 and 20 days, invoices are paid. So it's all about leadership. Also, there has to be political and administrative will to ensure that this happens. If there's no political and administrative work, then also we are not going to be able to fight. Thank you, honorable members. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to take them.
Thank you so much. Really needs to be to the issue. I'm trying to say nearly because of time for but thank you for the presentation. I guess this is information that I wanted to share with us from the research and findings. And then also I'm happy to hear that you have already issued out that instruction. I hope you didn't issue out because you're coming here.
No. We've got this invitation much later. It was just coincidental that the it was there. And also, Chairperson, you know, we normally issue an annual report on the payments within 30 days to SCOPA. We've already issued that to SCOPA and to the Standing Committee of Finance. We could in future also provide you with copies of those reports as well, as well as the quarterly reports that we submit to FOSSA, if the committee wants it.
We will.
Sorry, ma'am?
We appreciate.
Okay, going forward in the new financial year, we'll make sure that those reports are also submitted to you.
Thank you so much. I'd like to thank the department for this preparing and also traveling all the way to come and give us, and also corresponding to the issue. Serious concerns, I'm sure, is warranted, and then there was a proposal that was actually transported by everybody in this meeting that you will pay us a certain amount, but that will be in the next check. So if you will give me that time, I would also like to just to emphasize the areas of focus that we'd like you to come and present us. So, thank you very much. Remember, thank you very much for your coming to the meeting and also for your participation and thanks for your invaluable contribution. The meeting is adjourned. I'm going to go to the next one.